You probably all know by now, but I'm Jenny Neal, and this is the final session of the conference. And we'd like to say how fantastic it is, what stamina people have, and you realise, you know, perhaps during the second day of the conference, it's when you sort of think, oh my goodness, the first day, there's all the excitement, it's great. You sit up late talking to people. You have an extraordinarily full day the second day, the conference dinner. And the third day, oh my goodness, there's all these people I haven't talked to, all the things I haven't heard, and I've got to catch a plane back to whatever, or, you know, there's 500 emails sitting somewhere that I haven't answered. So the way we've structured, the conference committee structured this session was that afternoon tea is the reward at the end of the session. We'll also do the evaluation draw at the end of the session. And in between, we have a few other bits and pieces, but the particularly important thing is we have here a panel. As Susan said, we have two of our keynotes, who Phil and Bill, which sounds a bit like the sort of the twins, doesn't it? You know, of some Boy's Own magazine. And
well, that works.
Jess, who those of you who were at the dinner last night will have seen, has won the award for the emerging evaluator. And Ralph, now I'd hasten to add, I can't put this as tactfully as I might, as I can say, he's the other end of their spectrum. But however, he assures maturity. So as a fellow, one of the inaugural fellows. So what we're going to do is follow a format where each of the panellists is going to sort of do a round robin, and I, sort of being a bossy schoolmistressy type in a former life, we're thinking probably about three iterations where the panel will talk about something that was important for them. The next panellist may reflect on that, may have something different, pick it up, whatever. So we're hoping this will be the sort of panel at the end that also sets your way thinking, yes, that's what they took out of it, or yes, that really pulls something together, or why didn't they? So the conference ends on the same high note as it began. So, Phil, we'd like to start with you.
Right. Aren't I lucky? Well, we were asked to really reveal what we thought were some of the highlights and the impressions that we had of the last 3 days. I think one of them is, first of all, the very healthy condition of evaluation, the evaluation culture in this part of the world. And I think healthy, not just in the terms of the you know, what is being done and the diversity and the number of people, but there's both that diversity of who you are and what you do. And contrary to what I thought at the first, on Monday when I arrived, that there is also a holism. There's a sense in which this movement is going somewhere. I don't think it knows where it's going, but then nobody knows where they're going, so that's not too difficult. So I find that really encouraging. That, for instance, I would seem to be, you know, the first day I arrived here, I didn't expect to have all this reflections on RCT. Because I just, as I said in my talk yesterday, I thought we'd put that one to bed 15 years ago. What is nice is it's actually quite a healthy coming back to that, because it makes us look not just at random allocation trials, but it makes us look at the whole work of what we do. And I think what has come out of it for me is, out of the diversity has come a sense of commonality and a holism, of a wholeness that I think will only take us forward. Now, we've just come from a very interesting Q&A with Bill, where we've got even further into the evolutionary model, where Bill reminded us that we really don't know where we're going in evolution. It has no life, it has no being, it just it is. So I've got a couple of other things to say, but Bill can pick up on that, because I think that segues nicely into what he's been thinking about on the ecological evolutionary model.
Yeah, thanks, Phil. Yeah, I think where I wanted to go, I was surprised too, the RCT debates here, and we had a good example of that at the plenary, at the panel discussion yesterday. I want to thank Andrew Lee for really representing well the position that we've been talking about. But I think I also very much feel an interest in moving ahead. And I think if you're like me, you're probably thinking about where do we go from here with this whole issue of evidence. And so I just wanted to reflect for a moment on that, because I think we've seen some glimmers of where we might go, and I wanted to sort of highlight them and maybe help us to encourage us to take this in that direction. So one of the things that clearly came out is this idea of hierarchy of evidence, hierarchy of methodology, and its relationship to the idea of rigor. So you rank approaches to getting evidence, and then you say the one that's at the top of the rank is the rigorous one, right? I mean, that's basically what you're trying to do. And it is important for us to have hierarchies. We need rules of thumb. We need approaches like that. But you can also see that there are immense debates that occur around that. So here's what I'd like to suggest that we think about. Two things. We need to build hierarchies, not a hierarchy of evidence.
Yeah.
So I'd like us to start thinking about multiple hierarchies, and what would we have hierarchies about? Probably about different kinds of evaluation questions for different kinds of programs and different kinds of contexts, but certainly for different kinds of questions. So descriptive questions, we might want to have hierarchies. Correlational questions, needs assessment questions, and so on. I could imagine us having hierarchies of what are preferable methods in general, even with all the caveats about how those hierarchies are just in general. The other thing is that in each of those areas, not just in causal assessment, we need to be pushing for rigor. Across the board, rigor in qualitative methods, rigor in needs assessment, rigor in the development of program theory, rigor in the development of operationalizations of measures. In other words, we cannot cede the rigor argument just to the people who are arguing about a particular part of the puzzle. We need to make sure that rigor is something that we all are engaged in trying to encourage, and not let that term get absconded by just a few people. So the idea of multiple hierarchies that encourage us to think about what really are better or more preferable approaches to evidence generation of different types, I think would be something that would be a really worthwhile next step that all of you could engage in your work and help others to engage in.
I have to admit, I was a little reluctant to take on this assignment. when trying to talk my way out of it, I explained that I'd just arrived back from a month in Africa on Monday night, and the first 2 days of the conference was a little bit like a hallucinatory, jet-lagged day's dream. What I'd imagine it would be like. Yeah, but general philosophy in life is just to say yes and then try and work your way out of the mess that you get yourself into. but there's a few comments that I've heard throughout the week that have come back through that made it through the haze. And one today that the first that was interesting was about our colleagues, the Americans, brought their problems and their debate with them to the conference. And I think for me, that's actually a strength that I've really seen in over the last few days, is that there has been a level of debate in both the individual presentations and also some of the group sessions that, as a neuro evaluator, I've really enjoyed and learnt from. Something I've heard over a few of the last conferences, it tends to come up that people say, oh, we're a new profession, why are we still dealing with definitions, why are we debating the same old issues? And I have to say, I look at that as from a different angle. For me, it's more of a, I guess, like the action research thinking process where issues reemerge and we reconsider them with new insights, new experiences. And I think given the proportion of members in this society that are new, I think it's a very healthy practice that we go over these issues and reconsider them as a group and really bring that debate out into the light. So one of my favorite sessions has been yesterday when they had the different scenarios and there was debate over different approaches you'd take in evaluation. And I think that's often a challenge that we have on our own, is that we're presented with a scenario and a situation, and I often wish I could just be able to bore into the minds of my peers and colleagues and our elders and think, how would they approach this situation? So for me, that was a really helpful insight.
Thank you for that. Just a little anecdote. There were two elderly people sitting in a retirement facility, not quite there yet. although we are redesigning our bathroom so to allow wheelchair access. Anyway, one said to the other, "Oh, the food here is disgusting." And the other one said, "Yes, I couldn't agree with you more. And we can't get enough of it." And some years ago, I think the first perspective was what people had of evaluation. But these days, we've come a long way, and I think people are searching much more for evaluation. And this conference is an example of that. The way I set up my remarks initially, before Jenny kindly rearranged the whole structure, was what was said, and then contrasting it at the conference, and then what was said, what was not said at the conference. So I'll deal with the first bit at this point, and then we'll see what about the other. I think one of the things that was said was that there was a lot about evaluation design. But the evaluation design debate largely was about preordinate designs. It was not about emergent designs. And so it was addressing a certain need that we have for certain sorts of information or gathering sorts and sorts of data under particular circumstances and purposes, but it was ignoring a lot of other aspects. The second thing that was said quite a lot of was things to do with program theory and program logic. And it's amazing how this notion from pretty small beginnings back in the early 80s has now been picked up in Australia largely in the 90s due to the good work of two particular of our members, and has come to become part and parcel of what we do in almost any evaluation study. So program theory and program logic was talked a lot about, and I think appropriately, versus the way in which people were talking more in the 60s and 70s, which was about evaluation being a more atheoretical sort of form of applied research. Causality was another thing that was mentioned a lot or implied in the earlier days, seems like weeks ago, of the conference, but that also has developed and emerged through the conference. And one of the expressions of that today was in what Darrell Corley was saying in his discussion of causality in qualitative research, and reminding us that causality is not something that belongs to a particular research methodology or design. The final one has to do with meta-analysis. Now, meta-analysis has been bandied about a lot. I think there needs to be a lot more consideration, and maybe people know more about meta-analysis than I suspect or inferred from what's been said. But when Gene Glass introduced this idea at his presidential address in 1976 at the American Educational Research Association, and I was privileged to get about 6 months earlier a preview at a special little evaluation group meeting, He introduced this whole idea of reviews of research that had been done, but there were some key notions there, and only one of them was we might include or exclude certain studies based on certain criteria. But the other notion that he had was that even what are judged as relatively, not absolutely, but relatively poorly designed studies, the effect size, if it's there, is likely to be to come through and to help give us information on the overall trend of effects of programs of a particular type in this particular area. And I think there needs to be a not, from my point of view and what I assess people were talking about, was that there needs to be more study and thought by all of us as evaluators into just what the nature of and the variations, etc., of meta-analysis are, so that we can advise, use ourselves, and counsel our clients about an effective use of meta-analysis. Well, enough about what was said.
Right, I want to pick up on that because, as I've said a couple of times, I spend a lot of my time doing meta-analysis. It's like anything that's brought into the armory of tools and equipment and whatever that we use, it has to be thought of very carefully and critically. That there is a lot of stuff that passes for meta-analysis that is not meta-analysis. Mm-hmm. It's combinatorial, but it's not really a meta-analysis. There is, of course, a huge debate going on at the moment about the statistical basis, about the statistical independence of studies that get combined. And a couple of big meta-analyses in medicine recently have had to be reformulated because, in fact, the independence of studies was missed by the meta-analysts, and they were, as it were, they were double counting in a sense the effect and grossly exaggerating the effect. Now, I say this as a very strong proponent of meta-analysis and statistical meta-analysis, but and one who's seen it has had incredible impacts in medicine and is beginning to have that in some other areas like social welfare and in education. But I put out a plea that we mustn't use our critical acuity, because a lot of people are doing meta-analysis who either don't know what they're doing or they're doing it badly. And I'd hate people to think, oh, well, it must be, we must have a strong message here because it's done by a statistical meta-analysis. We really do need to check that out. A lot of mistakes are made that way. And also to remember, there are other types of meta-analysis. There is, I find, a lot of value in narrative meta-analysis, just, ordinary meta-systematic reviews. You get a great feeling for the breadth and the depth, the context, the contextuality of evidence when you do that, which you can miss if you just reduce something to a forest plot or to a simple, the little diamond at the bottom of the forest plot that gives you the effect size. You can really miss a lot because unless you've got that narrative sitting behind it. I was thinking that yesterday with Scared Straight, which I think Andrew was quite right about. What is what's interesting about Scared Straight is, of course, there have now been 12 randomized controlled trials of Scared Straight, and not one of them has found a positive effect size. He's absolutely right. It was the kids who were in the experimental group who landed up reoffending more than those in the control group. That's so when you look at it as a meta-analysis. But what is interesting is if you read Petrosino's analysis, don't just go to the meta-analysis. You've got to read the diversity of things that count as Scared Straight within the individual studies in different states of America, and you've got very different programs with very different methods of implementation, and that's what we need to know when we get to the practice end. Similarly, I know Petrosino very well, we've actually tracked down some qualitative studies that I'm trying to get Anthony to publish or to do something with, that actually were really in-depth interview studies with some of the kids who went through the Scared Straight programs. And what is interesting, and I think Andrew alluded to this, is what you find out from that is where it went wrong was the program theory. Because instead of youngsters actually being scared of prisons and of prison life and finding heavy offenders as scary beings, quite the contrary, they thought these were just the sort of guys they ought to become. This was really something they should do. Now, you don't get that when you read the much-quoted Petrosino et al. Benner analysis, and people nearly always go to the little point and show it's got very little variance. It's true. But if you go and read what's behind it, that's what's important in the meta-analysis, and I think that's something I take from this. That's, in a sense, a metaphor for this, what we've been talking about here. We do need to have those statistical experimental designs, but we also need to have the qualitative, ethnographic, contextual work that sits behind it.
Yeah, one of the things that I've noticed here this week, and I think Jessica, also alludes to, the Americans came over here and brought our problem, or it's not just our problem, but we certainly have this problem. I've been struck by, and I was commenting in the previous session that I've heard a number of comments from Australians and New Zealanders about the idea that, well, we can't engage in this thing the same way that others do because we don't have the resources, we're not big enough, and so on. And so in my desire to help us move ahead and move this forward, I'm trying to think of things that we can all sensibly do that would really advance the cause of evidence. And one of the things I would encourage you folks to think about, and then I'm going to go back to America tomorrow, so take it for what it's worth, right? One of the things I'd like to encourage you to think about is the idea of, in this association, forming a group, or maybe a couple of different groups, have them work independently. Get some bright people like Jessica and others, actually this would work best if we got our newest evaluators, the ones who are trying to understand the field, because what I think we need to do is to try to formulate some basic statements to policymakers about evaluation and evidence, and they need to be formulated at a level of people who are coming fresh to this, because that's where the policymakers are coming from. Very simple statements, 2 or 3 page little white papers, or a little what we did in last winter for the Obama administration, a roadmap for evaluation that had such simple stuff in it, but profoundly important for policymakers and politicians to hear. You should do evaluations of the programs that you're funding. You should build funding in for a good evaluation. Evaluations should use multiple approaches, and on and on and on. I mean, this is not stuff that anybody in the room couldn't help contribute to, and you would be contributing your voice to what others around the world are trying to do, and you could also borrow. You could take a look at what we said, and what if it makes sense for you? And we would love to have you folks working on this problem as well, because there's only so many of us that can work on these kinds of statements in the United States, and we've been struggling to get them written. Politicians and public policymakers need to hear messages in a nice, concise form. And so I guess I'd encourage you, as we move this debate forward about evidence and evaluation, start putting down even the simple thoughts that you have, and getting them engaged with the politicians and the policymakers. I think you'll find that interesting things could happen when you do that, and I'd certainly love to see what you come up with.
Thank you.
Be careful what you thank me for.
Yeah. I want to come back to that point about influence and utility, but just first, I was just thinking of another key comment that I really enjoyed earlier today, and that was from Paul Dignan, and he was making an articulation around the difference between program theory and program logic, and he's one of his most powerful arguments, I felt, was when he said, just get with the program, baby. And I think it's just useful to think about how we influence thinking in evaluation. And I think it's this balance between thinking about what's evidence and what's influence. And I appreciate that the theme of the conference has been around the nature of evidence, and that's a very useful and healthy discussion. But I think, yeah, in our work, that we need to keep looking beyond our boundary, beyond our borders. And I take on board Phil's comment from this morning about that disjunct between what level of evidence is enough for policymakers versus what level is enough for us. And it reflects a comment I read by Michael Quinn-Patton recently about how you can increase certainty, but you don't necessarily increase likelihood of influencing decision making.
Absolutely.
And I think in that balance, it's about thinking about the resourcing and the effort we put into making sense of our information, communicating and engaging and working with other partners and stakeholders. And I think in that chain of influence as well, it's at different levels. So we've talked a lot about that senior policy level, but I guess from my experience, mostly working around the community development program and with local government and community governance, it's around thinking around that full food chain or hierarchy. So thinking of influence from the sharks right down to the plankton levels. I think in our presentations, in our work, that's something I'd like to focus on more in thinking about how what's happened after our work. I think our presentations stopped just a little bit too short to look back at previous work and look at how different approaches have had more influence.
So just moving on to some of the things that were not said or might have been said. That's a much wider field, of course. One of the things I don't think, or wasn't said enough of, one of the things I don't think was said enough of was the developmental approach to program development, developing programs to be effective. We sort of tend to, or at least the people who fund us, tend to have this view that we'll design something the best way we can, we'll subject it to test, and when it fails, we'll throw it away and we'll start the whole process again. An incredibly wasteful approach. And I was really pleased when Bill came up with this notion, borrowing from Darwin, what I would call a developmental approach, where you certainly start off with the best you can do, but then you try and create an effective and efficient, etc., program by continual improvement of that program. We don't just throw things away unless they really are nasty and bad. A second thing is that I think we have not had much of a discussion about values in education at this particular conference, and it remains one of the central and one of the major things that we need to keep in mind, that in many different ways and many different aspects of the process, it is a value-based and influenced activity, not just what we do, but also what our clients do with the information that we provide to them. A third thing, and then I'll save the others up for later, has to do with hidden theory in evaluation. And just to give a very small example, whenever we design particular data collection procedures and instruments and observational procedures and so on, there is actually a theory underlying that. We're asking these particular questions of these particular people based on a particular theory that we've got of what that will yield for us that's relevant to the objectives of this particular study and what it's trying to achieve. And I think we could do a lot more digging underneath and being conscious of what the hidden theory is in our evaluations, and to bring it up front more for our clients so they also understand that.
Thank you. Talk about what we haven't heard, and that's partly because of the nature of who comes to these events. I haven't heard that much from the voice of either senior policymakers or politicians, because they're not here. But that might be something to think about for future conferences of this association. When we were really, really struggling with that bridge I talked about this morning and the sort of lack of fit between what we do and anybody take any notice of it, and also, by the way, in the same, if you want to read more about that stuff, about where civil servants go, just Google a piece called Analysis for Policy. We wrote a very sanitized version of it. Put it on the Cabinet Office website. It's probably got my name on it somewhere, but it's just called Analysis for Policy. But I can tell you more about the stuff we left out and stuff we put in. We also asked policymakers and also a couple of quite senior politicians, not only where they go for evidence, but what they read. And it was stunning that they don't read much at all. And they don't go to conferences, and they don't come to places like here. They don't hear this sort of discourse. They don't realize that there are these arguments going on and theories of change. You know, would mean very little to them. It probably have something to do with, you know, the change in their pocket rather than change as in the sense that we mean it. So what we did in 2007 at the Campbell meetings in London, the Campbell Collaboration meetings in London, was to get an entire session given over to policymakers, telling us what they wanted from us. It's a great format, and I learned it from, again, where I've learned a lot of my stuff, from people in Canada. And in that case, we had a Minister of Health, we had somebody who was from their Ministry of Finance or their Treasury, and very senior civil servants, and it was a complete role reversal. They sat there and told us what they would like in terms of knowledge and evidence and evaluation and why we were of no use to them. Now, it's a little hard to take, but it's a very instructive enterprise, and what is good is to get that dialogue going. And the way we did it organizationally it's difficult in this format, but if you have people in tables, like I see there's another conference next door, if you have people in cabaret tables, you get the voice of the senior civil servant, the voice of the policymaker, the voice of the minister, very short and sweet, and they're very good at that, you know, very good at giving a pithy message, and I say pithy, a pithy message in a very short number of words. Honestly, I did. And then you put it to the tables to say, right, you've got 15 minutes to come up with a solution to this guy's problem, okay, and you have 10 tables. You have a really wonderful dialogue going. Now, I just put it out there, it might be something worth thinking of for future organizations of the meeting, because it's one way in which we can begin to bridge that gap, that bridge that I was talking about this morning. And it's also helped, given that we are now asking for our policymakers to be explicit in the theories of change that they put into their policy making. Given they don't know what it is, it's not surprising they don't do it. That might be one way to help them to find out.
Very interesting. I like the turn here to starting to think about what has not been said. And this is really wacky, and probably in an evolutionary sense should not survive this meeting. but it does occur to me that one thing I have never heard said about evidence is has to do with what do the people whom the evidence ultimately affects think the evidence ought to be for the programs that they are participating in or receiving. And so I began thinking about what would we have to do in order to find out what people who receive medical treatments think about what level of evidence they would like to see for their treatments, what people who are engaged in receiving educational programs should think about, or social, you just run down the line. And what would we have to do in order to lay it out for them in a way that they could then say, oh, you guys are doing that? You've got to be kidding me. I mean, I think it would be really interesting to see. It would force us to try to articulate what it is that we're trying to do with evidence generation. I think that alone would be an interesting exercise. But I think that people who are the ultimate recipients of this stuff would likely have some very interesting insights and very interesting perspectives to offer us. So I'm sort of imagining something like the exercise you're talking about, where we have to, almost in a trial-like fashion or something, where we have to say, well, here's a problem that you might be receiving a program on or be a participant in, and here's how we go about doing this. And almost in lawyer fashion, you have to lay out the case. Here's how we do this stuff. Now, what do you think of this? I've never heard of anybody doing that. I don't know if you guys have, but it seems to me like it would be really worthwhile to do. And so I leave you with that thought. It'd be kind of fun to see, and let's see if that survives.
Thank you. Recently, I've become a lot more interested in strength-based approaches. So I'm just going to shift the focus from the deficits back to what the conference did provide.
The optimism of youth. Yeah.
No, just because it was the point I'd already prepared, and I just back on the spot.
The pessimism of youth.
Experience. So something I really enjoyed in the conference is and I think this has been evolving over the last 4 years, is the increased focus on the issues in evaluation in international development. I think that's been a deliberate effort, and also with more support from both the donors end, but also the practitioners working in that field to bring that skills and knowledge base into this forum. Just one particular content area that I really enjoyed was a presentation on the use of additionality. And what I particularly liked about that was thinking about how we add value, or how programs add value at all levels, from inputs through to outcomes and impact. And I guess there's been a lot of debate for a long time over contribution at the outcomes impact level. But I think for me, that really highlighted again the need to not lose track of at the input level as well. And I guess that fancy word of fungibility. But I think in development, it's a critical issue that when we put something in, does that mean that others are putting less in, or it's shifting somewhere else? So I think just remembering that issue is something I'll personally take home. The other area in international development that really struck a note for me was hearing the roundtable of our Papua New Guinean colleagues. And I think it's, it was a rare space to actually hear directly back from the colleagues that we work with. So that was a really important opportunity, I think, for us to listen. And I think a real message that came through from those people around the roundtable was about what they're looking for is not so much capacity in terms of skills and knowledge, but capacity in terms of opportunities, and opportunities in terms of having trust and confidence in their skills and their local knowledge. And I think as the Australian Aid Program continues to expand and more of us move into that area or dapple in it, I think it's our responsibility to look for ways of partnering or mentoring or working with local practitioners, or stepping back and just linking those people up with the donors and the programs where possible, so that we're not, I guess, standing in their way, but working with them or supporting them. And I think that's something we can do as individuals, but also as a society. I think it's interesting to see how we can further support those networks to grow and develop.
One of the among the things that I won't say about what was not said is is my strong commitment and hoping that, there'll be many more to join us on empirical research on evaluation. So we won't talk about that. It's a bit like Nixon saying that I won't raise the matter that Kennedy would be the first American president who was Catholic. But thanks, Bill, because raising that business about whose information should we be gathering. And really, evaluation, as I see it, is an audience-oriented or a client-oriented form of applied research. It's not for us, the researchers, or our peers. It's for them, and what they value and think is important information is what the information that we should be at least thinking about gathering. But just a couple of other things that among the things that were not said. One is that the standards were hardly mentioned. In fact, Chris Milne said in his session this afternoon that this whole conference has largely been about the accuracy standards in one sense or another, but not about the utility, the feasibility, or the propriety standards. And they're things, of course, we should not lose track of. But just to tie all this together, in a sense, getting back to where we started at the beginning of the conference, I think another thing, in a way a crucial thing that was not really said, or clearly or loudly enough, was what Ernie House wrote about and back in the late 70s and then in his book Evaluating with Validity in 1980, was what he called the evaluative argument. Now, in his concept, evaluation is about forming an argument in relation to the program. And then we're engaged in gathering evidence in relation to that argument. When you view it from this point of view, then there's a vast range, the full range of possible evidence to be gained by a full range of possible methods and procedures that could be appropriate for being included within this argument and helping us to develop a convincing argument about the program. I'll leave it there.
Okay, well, I can see that we could actually have this panel keeping on round robbing for at least another hour.
No, that's fine.
But we've got one more job for Jessica to do. What we have is all those good people who filled out the evaluation of the conference. We've got two prizes. We have one prize that can only go to someone who's here, and the other prize will go, if we may, of course, she may, of course, draw out the names of people, both of whom are here, or she may pull out names of one person who's here and one who's not. So it's a bit like, you know, lucky tip. Now, we've sort of tossed these round.
Maybe it's a peacemaking to the American
brotherhood. I will hold the box for you and share in the responsibility.
Well, I'll take the first one, you take the second one.
All right, there we go. We'll make it international. How about that, Jessica?
Okay.
So the lucky winner of
for what?
The first one. Okay. That they're book vouchers from Footprint Books.
Trish O'Connell.
Trish O'Connell.
Centre for Eye Research Australia. Yeah!
Yay! Yay.
Now, all right.
What's this? You sort of have to leap if I come here.
Thank you very much.
Congratulations,
Thank
Trish.
You very much.
And what a good evaluator. Filling out the form.
And do we have her form here?
We now read it out.
That's right. Okay, here we go.
Dig deep on this one.
Okay, really shake them up. Random.
Right. Ooh. Gabby Fennessy.
Gabby.
You can pay me now.
Do you need
just before.
Do you need their two sheets?
No, because they can collect them. J- just the final few words, there's one minor sort of housekeeping thing, which is the papers for the conference. If you have not, if you were a presenter and had not yet sent them in, and this includes me, I have to say, please do so within the next 10 days. The conference papers go up on the AES website so that everyone can look and see them. But I just had the message from the journal editors and from other journal, for the AES journal to say, because your paper is on the website, this is for the information, it does not necessarily count as a publication. And if you would like to sort of perhaps take aboard some of the feedback or some further thoughts, the journal editors are very happy to receive copies of your paper to be considered for either the refereed or the non-refereed sections of the journal, and which again means that you get wider coverage. Now, in the best Olympic tradition, as we say thank you very much to the Canberra Committee, and I think we could say thank you to them again. We know how much incredible amount of work that goes into preparing the conference, and we're hoping that they all have a lovely, relaxing weekend ahead of them while we go home and do all the things that we should have done. And they're probably doing the things they should have done over the last 12 months, which will now come to the top of their list. So in the best tradition, we're actually going from one capital to another. And I'd like to ask David Turner to come up and do a brief commercial for the 2010 conference.
Thank you, Jenny, and kia ora, everyone. Yes, I caught a brief commercial it will be. I simply want to invite you all to come over this time next year, end of August, beginning of September, to Wellington for our 2010 conference. You see the what is essentially the postcard front there, and you have a postcard in your satchels explaining that the conference theme is reflecting on evaluation, by which we're intending to indicate both that we want evaluation practitioners to kind of look at their own practice, to reflect on how evaluation can be done better, but we also want to have evaluation practitioners and other people, and I noted the idea about involving perhaps policy people, politicians, and others in the conference. We want other people to help reflect on what evaluation contributes to the wider society and its wider significance, so you can look either way. We have speakers coming who I think will help to challenge people in the field to really think about their role in the wider society. Elliot Stern is coming from the UK. Tom Schwant from Illinois will be here. Donna Mertens, a past president of the AEA, now at Gallaudet University in Washington, will be here. Jane Davidson, who used to work with Michael Scriven and is now doing her own practice in Auckland. And Roger Maka, who is an indigenous scholar who's worked extensively in Canada as well as New Zealand. Further information on all these people, as well as nice little photos, will be on the website, which is live tomorrow. So we're pretty much getting on our way. And when the time comes, I hope you will give us your proposals, give us your abstracts for workshops or papers, and come join us in Wellington.
Thank you. Thank you, David. And it just remains for me to just give a few, one thing, those of you who are into recycling, leave your lanyards on the registration desk. And I thank you all for coming. This has been a fantastic conference. It's done all the things a conference should do. It's raised issues, it's made you think, and I hope that you'll go away enlivened, maybe tired, but with a whole lot to think about, ready to come next year. We particularly thank those people who have had to travel long distances people who've perhaps had to do incredible juggling acts with family and workplaces to be here. So thank you for taking the time for making this such a successful conference, because obviously without good attendees, we just wouldn't have the sort of conference we have. So travel safely, and we'll see you all next year. Goodbye. You probably should think.